The following presentation is brought to you by The Realm Network.
Today on Mr. Media, I'll talk to Emmy and Peabody Award-winning writer, director, and producer Richard Kramer, whose work you may know from TV series including 30-something, My So-Called Life, Tales of the City, and Once and Again. He's just published his first novel, These Things Happen, and Oprah Winfrey's production company, Harpo, has optioned it, and HBO has committed to a pilot based on the book. Stick around. If you're having an emotional crisis, this guy may not solve it for you, but he'll do a hell of a job of capturing it on paper. So much media, so little time. Who keeps track of it all? That would be me. This is Bob Andelman, and this is a Mr. Media interview, brought to you by Amazon.com, Audible.com, and 1-800-DIAL-DJs. Please stop by the website, MrMedia.com, click on our advertisers, support the show. And remember, there's more than 1,000 interviews available at MrMedia.com. We've been doing this since February 2007. Hope you'll find something you like. And thanks for listening. Mr. Media is recorded live before a studio audience of current and former teenage girls who can't believe that Claire Danes in My So-Called Life and the Claire Danes in Homeland is playing that they're playing two completely different characters. Wink, wink. In the new media capital of the world, St. Petersburg, Florida. Yeah, a lot of people think it's the same character, don't they?
Yes. We can't believe how she grew up. I mean, we think of her at 14, you know, when she was this little girl, you know, who just came in having done one television show. And we just sort of went, oh, my God, who is this? Yeah. She was completely focused and adult at 14.
Thirty-something, My So-Called Life, Tales of the City, Once and Again. I feel confident saying that I have seen the complete runs of two television series with which writer, director, and producer Richard Kramer has been associated.
That's nice.
30-something and Once and Again. And I will add that I feel equally confident saying that I have never seen a single episode of either of the other two, My So-Called Life and Tales of the City. Not that there's anything wrong with that. 30-something and Once and Again were two shows that spoke to me at times when I think I probably matched up well with their demographic. Young, married, and still married, I guess. Have I ever not been married? It's really kind of hard to remember at this point. Now, as for My So-Called Life, I was long past high school when it enjoyed its short but inspired run. And I've never been gay. Happy, sure. But Armistead Maupin's Tales of the City was just not a show I was drawn to for any reason. But now that Richard Kramer has added the word novelist to his resume, his first book, These Things Happen, has almost incidentally, I think, rolled together elements of all four of these aforementioned shows. Straight marriage, remarriage, gay marriage, straight teens, gay teens, and lots of really delicious sounding food. All into one uniquely organized tale. Now, These Things Happen came out in paperback just this week, and HBO recently committed to a half-hour comedy pilot based on the book, and it will be produced by Oprah Winfrey's Harpo Productions. Not bad, Richard. Not bad at all. Richard Kramer, welcome to Mr. Media.
Hey, Bob. It's really good to be here.
Nice to have you here. And congratulations on the book. I, you know, first novel, goes to paperback, sell it to Oprah Winfrey. I'd say you were lucky for a first-timer, but considering your body of work, luck may not have that much to do with it.
You're leaving out Audible.com, which I recorded. I did 3 days sitting in a tiny, tiny little booth. I hope that some of your viewers are old enough to remember Adolf Eichmann and his trial in Jerusalem, where he was known as the man in the glass booth. And I felt like the man in the glass booth as I was doing this. But they were nice enough to let me record it. And it was a very interesting experience to hear those words coming back to me in my own voice wearing headphones, and I just, some of it I loved and some of it I wanted to run out screaming.
I've had that experience. I've had that experience. A biography that I wrote several years ago, I got the chance to record it, and I recorded it also. And it's the same thing. You're in that booth. You're alone in the booth because there's an engineer outside, and you're reading it. And I actually had to do mine twice because the first time they did it, they didn't record it properly, and so I had to go back a second time. And I know my own experience was I was constantly rewriting what I had already written because – It just didn't sound right, right?
Did you really do that?
I mean, did.
I did the same, and they let me do it. I said, I'm going to go a little bit off text here and just make it better. And they said, fine. You know, there's no policeman watching. And I did that probably a dozen times.
It's hard because when you're writing and you're not thinking about how it's going to actually sound in the ear. You know, I don't know about you, but I know when I write, I'm writing and I want it to sound – like a lot of times I'll write with a co-author and I'm writing to their voice. So I want it to sound like you're sitting across from that person. But then when you actually hear it, literally hear it through your ear, it sounds different. And so sometimes it has to be fixed.
Yeah, it does. What was your book about? This?
It was an old comic book artist named Will Eisner. I did his.
Oh, he's a credible legend.
Yeah, that guy.
Legend.
I did his authorized biography. Came out just right after he died, and
he's influenced so many people.
He was a good guy too. Yeah. So it's interesting. So, and by the way, no need to brag about the audiobook. I should have said that.
I want to say one thing to your audience, which is I look like I'm mildly insane. I am looking at a green light at the top of my computer screen. And I ordinarily, my neck is not clenched like this, and I'm pretending that I'm talking to Bob in an impersonal way when I am completely a slave of electronica.
Well, it didn't really seem that intimate until that point, but okay. Now I guess the illusion is broken. The fourth wall, we've gone through it.
There's a fifth wall here.
Yeah. If only we were Bruce Willis and Cybill Shepherd breaking the fourth wall.
Oh my God!
But instead, folks, you're stuck with us.
they were on a couple of years before we went on, and they were, I think, basically just winding down when we were starting up on 30 something, and they were the benchmark for ABC series at that time because it was so fresh and so funny and so confident in what it was doing, and we all loved it.
Well, and you guys got all that right, and you left out the part, where they hated each other so much. You guys didn't. I don't think you covered that part.
Yeah. We never had that.
Yeah, and you can see that just from the actors on that show who continually show up in each other's work, even to this day.
Yes. Everybody has stayed close. It was a very unusual. I mean, you know, I'm so glad that you saw all the episodes and you were a fan of the show. And you know, we waited forever for the DVD to come out. And there were rights problems with it. And, you know, we would all get asked all the time, why is there no DVD of 30-something? And now there is, of all the four seasons. But one of the things that was remarkable about it was that all of us were sort of we were all at the same point in our lives. We were all within a year or two the exact same age. Many of us had gone to college together. Many of us had known each other for years. So, and we had all had our ups and our downs and our ins and our outs with our careers. And there was no star per se. There was the group and us, and it never, ever got weird or out of control or somebody, you know, acting like a diva, never once with anybody. That was wonderful. It's wonderful to work like that.
Do you guys ever, when you think back on the way that the ad agency was set up on that show and all the way it was set up basically as a fun time place, do you ever look at Google and think, hey, you stole that from us?
Well, if they did, more power to them. The ad agency was less fun as it went on.
Yeah.
You know, at the beginning it was a lot of fun. But, you know, one of the things that we were doing – I think without even really realizing what we were doing, we were following these guys from innocence to a kind of cynicism and a kind of sadness about what it's like to be successful, what it's like to be not successful but loving it, and then becoming successful and not loving it. Mm-hmm. And that happened over 4 years. And that's, you know, I don't think that we ever sat down and consciously said that, but it just happened because we were reflecting our own lives. And not that we were so, you know, miserable at the end, but you do change over time. And in a show that is so close to the people who are making it, you reflect the changes that you are going through without ever really being aware of it.
One of the criticisms, I think, late in the show's run was that it wasn't as much fun anymore because they were all so miserable. They didn't like their jobs. There was too much politics on the job. The couples weren't getting along quite the way they did it. A little of that magic, as it happens in work and in marriage, it just kind of, you get on each other's nerves at certain points.
Well, you know, it's you know, one of the things we all noticed was that at the beginning, it was about a moment in your life when you can still drop in on your friends unannounced. And when you can walk through the door and it's not anything other than fun. And then as you get on a little bit, you have to call ahead. You have to book the time. You know, you're not as free. You have kids. You have a wife. You have a husband. You know, you have a job. You have a this. You have a parent, you know, who needs you. You have all the things that any real life has that makes life not as light and as free as it is when those things aren't pressing upon you so much. And so the first year was joyous because they were all beginning life together, even though they were in their mid-30s mm-hmm. And a little bit younger. And that's what I think, you know, we saw was that, you know, the ability to just hang out was not there as easily.
Yeah, it's interesting. I'm just, as we're talking about it, I hadn't planned to go off immediately onto 30-something, but yeah, I mean, it was a great cast. You've got people who've acted a great deal. You've got several people from that cast who've gone on to direct a lot.
A lot of them, right? Yeah.
I saw, I think it just, like in the last week, I think I saw Patricia's name in something that she's going to be acting in afresh.
She is going to be in a show that is created by the guys who do all the things like Transformers. Their show right now is Sleepy Hollow.
Oh.
Which Ken Olin, her husband, is the executive producer of. And they're creating another pilot, and she's on it. She likes to work.
Yeah.
She was on Brothers and Sisters all those years. She loves working, and she's great.
Oh, yeah. She was the mother of the girl who was introduced late. I can't remember all the names, right? She was the new wife that they found of
No. That was Patricia Callenber. She was Gary's wife, who was introduced in the second season, the one who nobody liked.
Okay.
Yeah. Patricia Wittig was the one.
Yeah. I'm sorry.
Who, among other things, got cancer in the third season.
I remember that, yeah.
And she won 3 Emmy Awards in a row, which no one has ever done before.
Yeah, like I said, a lot of talent on that 30-something show.
Yeah, it was fun.
Yeah. Well, all right, so let's come back to these things happen, because I do want to talk to you about the other TV shows later on.
Sure. But,
how does a guy like yourself who's done all this TV work move so effortlessly from TV to writing a novel? I mean, it's not necessarily a natural transition, at least not that we've always seen in the past.
Well, first of all, it wasn't effortless. You know, I had a friend say to me the other day, he sent me something that he had done, and I said, you know, you made some really smart choices in that. And he said, smart is what's left when you run through everything else. And effortless is what's left after you've exhausted every other possibility. I had always wanted to write a novel. I started out writing when I was in college. I wound up in Los Angeles and in the television and movie business really by accident. It became my life and career. And then, you know, I'd say 4 or 5 years ago, I just said, I feel like I just don't want to do it anymore. It's gotten harder and harder. Mm-hmm. I've gotten older and older. It is it's a young person's business. You have to be willing to offer up your life on an altar and be there 16 hours a day and care about it beyond anything else. And I just didn't feel that anymore. Hmm. And suddenly I started scribbling, you know, a couple of things down, and I didn't even know I was writing a novel until I was at least a couple of months into it. I was just trying to pass the time, and suddenly I had 30 pages.
Wow.
And suddenly it was suggesting another 10 pages or another 2 pages, and then I would put it down for 2 weeks and think, well, that was whatever that was. And then 4 months later, I had 60 pages. And at about that point is when I knew you were writing a book. Hmm. And then, you know, talking about effortless, I had to go through the agents who turned it down, you know, the publishers who turned it down. I ultimately found an incredible agent who had a really good, you know, piece of advice for me. She says, only one person has to like it. And that... She said, that's all you need. And she was right. She said, somebody is going to like this. But it took a year to find, you know, the right publisher. And none of this felt effortless at the time. I sort of, once I finished the book, I sort of stood back and I said, well, I'm just going to sort of watch how this plays out. It was at a very interesting time for me because I had already been through an entire career. So I was not fresh out of the University of Iowa, you know, master's program in writing, mm-hmm. where I was, you know, had to go to the parties and I had to be in Brooklyn and I had to do this and I had to do that. And the book had to be like this in order to get published. Whether it got published or not wasn't a make or break deal for me. My attitude was it would have been nice if it did, really nice. And if it didn't, at least I had done it.
Right. Now,
it's a great place to be coming from, and you can't create that artificially. It's just that's where I was in my life.
Mm-hmm. Was part of the challenge? It's got a unique narrative. I mean, I should point this out. It tells the story. We can talk about the story in a minute, but it tells the story. Every chapter is in the voice of a different person in the book.
Yeah.
And so it's a little jarring at times because the voice changes. You get to the end of a chapter and you've just gotten comfortable with one person, and then suddenly you're hearing in your head as you're reading the voice of another character. One minute it's a teenage boy, then it's another teenage boy, then it's a parent, then it's another parent, or then it's not a parent, but it's just – so were there people who just said, throw this away, throw this narrative style away, just tell a straight story?
They came at that in a very, very nice way. I had a couple of offers to rewrite the book as a young adult novel. And from three terrific publishers. And I was such a creature of the Hollywood system that I was used to saying yes to whatever anybody asked.
I was going to ask you about that later. Yeah, okay.
And Gail Hockman, my agent, she said, honey, she said, this isn't Hollywood. You don't have to do this. I want you to hang in. Hmm. And if she hadn't said that, I wouldn't have hung in because these other publishers wanted me to write it only from the main teenage boy's point of view. And they said, this is, you know, you'll have a bestseller from this. And I had an agent who had enough integrity to say, you don't have to do that. I don't want you to do that. I'm not going to let you do that. And we didn't have a publisher at that point. And I thought, oh my God, she's crazy. But I'm so glad she did that with me.
I hope this
won't. That kind of answers your question.
Yeah, you know, no, it does.
Yeah.
Now, I hope this won't offend you, but I still, having read the whole book, thought of it as still being kind of a YA book. I mean, a young adult book. It's, you know, I'd be perfectly comfortable handing it to my 17-year-old and saying, you'll probably like this. But a 14 or 15-year-old, it's that the topic is so au courant, if you will. And it's I thought it worked very well as a YA book.
I take that only as a good thing. When I wrote it, I didn't think about it one way or the other. These were just the people who presented themselves. Mm. And, you know, it since it opens with the main kid's point of view, you expect, as you said, you know, that you were jarred a little bit at the end of certain sections that another voice came in. But you expect that he's going to be the one who leads it. You know, it's not really about him. the book. He is a strong part of it, mm-hmm. but it's not really his story. And, you know, I thought at the time when I had these other people interested in me making it a YA novel, could I carry it through all in his perspective? And I didn't think that I could. But I'm happy for whoever, you know, reads it. I think it's a book for families. I think it's a book for fathers. I think it's a book for mothers. I think it's a book for stepfathers. I think it's a book for, you know, gay parents, for straight parents, for straight teenage kids, for gay teenage kids. You know, I you know, one of the things that my agent said when she read it for the first time, she called me the next day and she said, you know, she said, honey, she said, this book is for everybody, isn't it? And I said, yeah, I hope so.
You have an agent who still calls you honey. How sweet.
She's great. She's great.
And this is kind of, since you mentioned it that way, I mean, this is kind of, if you watch the ABC sitcom, Modern Family, and you wonder what it, maybe a dramatic, somewhat dramatic, well, rather dramatic version of that might be, this could kind of fit that. It's
well, that's fantastic. I love that show. And friends of mine are the writers of it, and they are having the time of their life doing it. And if you know, we do. I'm thrilled to have it compared to that because that's a very high mark, you know, to do that. That show is amazing.
Now, as you're writing this book and as you are switching the voice, was that difficult? Is there anything you've done in television, for example, that's comparable to switching the voice like that from section to section or act to act? Okay,
all the time because you know, writing in the voices of individual characters was something that I'd been doing for 35 years,
okay.
You know, and, you know, one of the things that we prided ourselves on 30-something was that everybody sounded different. You know, everybody had a way of expressing themselves, a way of speaking that was unique. And that was the thing that all the writers tried to do was that this character didn't sound like that character. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we believed in, and I still believe that one of the hallmarks of lousy writing is when everybody sounds the same.
You mean like a show like, oh, I don't know, NYPD Blue, for example?
No, well, I like that show, and he's a wonderful, wonderful.
But they all sounded the same after the first season. Every character spoke with the same accent. They used the same phrasing. They used the same bad words. It was insane. I couldn't watch it after the first season.
That is true. That is true. But it was easy for me. Not easy, because, I mean, as you know, there's nothing that's easy about writing, but it wasn't painful.
Right.
For me, you know, that's the distinction. Not painful versus painful in writing. Those are the two poles that you go between. But it was not painful for me to get into the voices of these other people. Marshall Herskovitz, who was somebody who I've worked with many times, who was one of the creators of my so-called life, he said something I never forgot. He said, every writer has to have living in him the teenager who he was or who she was. And I thought that was one of the wisest things I ever heard. It's like, you know, writers keep that kid alive in them because that is when you are most receptive in your life, when you are most influenceable, when you are most emotional, when you are most nuts. And that's what you want to draw on when you write, is that kind of freshness of being. That's one of the reasons I think that my so-called life worked. I mean, we were all in our 40s when we wrote it. Mm-hmm. You know, we didn't have a young person on the staff. I mean, we never went to a high school, you know, and said, you know, what are kids saying now? We just wrote ourselves.
Nobody on the staff was cruising the high schools, you know?
Never.
Oh, okay. Just checking, you know.
Never. It's amazing, you know, but that just, we just never thought of doing that.
Now, there were no, I'm trying to remember, there were no teens on 30-something because they
were babies.
Yeah, they hadn't reached that point. The kids got a little older, obviously, over 4 years. So my so-called life had teens. Once and Again had teens.
Yes, it did.
Right? I love that show, by the way. I got to say.
I loved it, too. I missed it.
Yeah. I was a big fan of Billy's from The Rocketeer. I would follow him anywhere after that. Although I do recall interviewing him here a short interview and mentioning The Rocketeer, and he just kind of groaned. So, you know, it was a one-way street. So, but anyway, yeah, no, that was a terrific show. And the charisma, the chemistry between him and Oh, I can picture. I can't think of her name all of a sudden.
Cela Ward.
Cela Ward. Oh, my God. Yeah. That woman. And then she showed up on House later, and that was great.
Yes.
But so, I mean, what is that? Being able to write for teens, is it – were your teen years that significant to you personally? Or is it just – are you just good at just going from, you know, kind of getting into – slipping into the body of a different type of person?
I think every writer has the same teenage. And it's they're both in the world and watching the world. And I think that you're not aware of it while it's happening, you know, but I think that the thing that makes you a writer happens then, which is the split of being able to have experience and describe experience as it's happening, which is to have experience and to hoard experience for later. And, you know, I'm a writer. Every writer I know, it's the same thing. It was just getting – and I have two teenagers in this. I have three teenagers because I have the girl. I have, you know, Wesley, Theo, and Shannon. And I loved writing them because all I had to do was just sort of dig around a little in my memory of myself. And, you know, I'm not a teenager, obviously. I mean, my teenage years were in the 60s.
You're not a teenager? That look is not a teenage look?
It's not a teenage look anymore. It's a tired old teenager if it's a teenager.
What does that say about me? Never mind. I don't need to know.
All right. Well, whatever. But, you know, I'm talking about, you know, being a teenager in 1967. And that's a very different world. But in writing Wesley and in capturing Wesley and in being Wesley – Wesley is – I was very pleased that people felt that he seemed right now, but he's me right then.
Mm-hmm. Well, no teenager – and believe me, I've had this conversation with my daughter just last night. No teenager believes that anyone has ever lived their life before. So,
that's very beautifully put. It's very true.
It was handed to me it was kind of like this last night. So yeah, I know that teenagers don't believe that anyone has ever gone through what they've been through. So you know, it's interesting that you could transfer your experiences in the you know middle late 60s to this character. But it really is, the similarities are there. We all have to go through that, the rites of passage. We all have to grow up. We have to mature. We have to go through some hard things to bring us around to those things.
Well, you know, it's funny with this book. This is something that I said once before, but this conversation brings it back for me. Is that the book is paradoxical, and I realized this, you know, long after I had finished it and it had been published. Is it's a coming of age story, but it's not about teenagers, and it's a coming out story that is not about gayness. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to do something. Again, you realize what you wanted to do after you have done it. First, you just have to do it and not realize what you're doing and not know what you want. Because when you know what you want, you tend to make it boring. It's like boxes you in. But if you can get through a draft of just churning it and churning it, then you see, oh, that's what I wanted to do. And I wanted to do a story that I wanted to sort of subvert expectations. You know, the teenagers in this book are very together. You know, they have already, in a funny way, because of the circumstances that they live in, they have already come of age. The adults haven't. Hmm. And, you know, the gay characters in the book are not troubled about the gayness. But to me, coming out in this book is about coming out to yourself in all the aspects of your being. Mm-hmm. And the adults in this book who pride themselves on being so cool and so tolerant about everything, find out that they're not. And they have to come out to themselves and realize, I am not the perfect, wonderful person I always thought I was and have worked so hard to be. I am complicated. I am contradictory. I don't always make sense. I don't always do things that I would admire in somebody else. And I just have to live with that. Hmm. And that's a kind of coming out to me, because I think that's true of everybody. You know, we no matter how, you know, generous and good a life we lead, we hold things in ourselves. We hold beliefs that we're not even aware that we hold. until something happens, until these things happen. That's the meaning of the title. Until these things happen that reveal to ourselves who we actually are in our entirety.
Now, Richard, I did deliberately did not try to explain the plot of the book because I don't know how much you would feel gives away the story, because there's a big pivotal moment early on that drives a lot of what happens the rest of the book. Do you want to – I mean, have you got an Evelyn Wood version of the plot that you want to share so people know what we're talking about?
Well, first of all, let me say that the book is less about its plot to me, and this is just the kind of work that I always did in television, than about the characters' attitudes towards it and how the characters respond. Mm-hmm. I tried to create a plot that was interesting enough to keep the pages turning, but I'm much more interested in following the process of thought, which is why it's all in the first person, of the major characters, because we go into how they're seeing things in a way we never could, for example, in a movie or on television, which is driven totally by dialogue. But to not give away anything too terrible, the book is set in New York City, among the people who admire themselves tremendously for achievement, for education, for beliefs that they hold. There's a story that I don't have time to tell here, but I can tell you another time. It's just sort of where that came from. I also grew up in a world like that. Mm. And it's filled with lovely people who are just as real and screwed up as anybody else, if not more so, because they are protected by their own self-satisfaction. Mm. And it's about this kid who lives with his mom and his extremely menschy stepfather in one part of town, while his father, who turned out to be gay, lives in the other part of town with his partner of 10 years. And the kid, when he gets to be almost 16, says, "I really want to get to know Dad better." And everybody within the circle of these people thinks, "Oh, this is just marvelous. we're going to let this happen, and we're going to let it show how tolerant we are. We're going to let this 15-year-old boy move into an apartment with two gay men, and everything is going to be wonderful." Well, everybody thinks it's wonderful except the father. And when the kid moves in with the father, he experiences the father being very distant and seeming not even to want him there. And the father, who is a character who a lot of people have a lot of feelings about, is very uncomfortable having his son live in the situation where he is living with another man.
Is that it, or is he just – I didn't really get that so much as I got that he just wasn't comfortable being a father. It seemed to me that when he got divorced, probably the happiest moment of his life was realizing he wasn't going to have to raise this kid, which he just had no connection to.
That's very much part of it too. But this is a guy who's not comfortable with being anything. Mm. And he has compensated for that by being somebody who helps everybody selflessly. That is his life and his career. He is, a lawyer on the side of any good cause. Mm-hmm. Because, although I don't think that people really think about themselves this way, But a novelist has to. One of the reasons is that he feels so ill at ease in himself, and he envies people who are comfortable in their own skin.
Well, he pushed aside his wife, and he's created distance between himself and his partner, and distance between himself and his son. But he's perfectly comfortable with complete strangers talking about very intimate things, just not with anyone who's technically close.
That's exactly right. Mm-hmm. And somehow, I can sense from your being a dad that you have, not that you are that guy, but you have sympathy for that guy, which is helpful to know.
Yeah.
And the kid, when he moves in, finds this, but what he finds that is even more interesting is he finds a relationship with his father's partner.
Right.
That is the relationship he wants to find with his father. And the father's partner is a gay man who was a chorus boy in Broadway shows, who never thought about having a child, who never wanted one, who suddenly finds himself a natural parent to this boy who is very in need of a father figure. Mm-hmm. And they have this immediate rapport. And everybody is very okay with this, or pretending to be okay with this, until an incident happens that I will not reveal, because I think, to keep this pleasure, that makes the parents fear that the kid might be gay. And I give away nothing here when I say he isn't. But they fear it, and because they fear it and can't stand fearing it, they decide that the father's partner, who has formed this terrific relationship with the boy, must be doing something very, very wrong.
Yeah.
And that is really where the story starts to explode from, because it blows this family apart, and it also winds up bringing them back together. And they have all had to face seeing themselves, because these things happen. And, you know, one of my points is that you're lucky if they do, because as overwhelming and traumatic as they can be, they help you know yourself. And this kid, so this justifies it both as a YA novel, even though the way I've described it makes it an A novel. This kid has been a light that has been cast into this family. And his father's partner, whose name is George, has maintained himself with great dignity and love.
And food.
And food, yes. He is a born nurturer. He runs a restaurant.
Yes.
And one of the things that was really fun about doing this was making mouth-watering descriptions of food.
Yeah, you're killing me with that sometimes.
I was writing it.
Yeah, that was difficult. I felt like I gained weight reading it.
It's funny. Let's say that. I mean, yeah, this is a grim story by any means. I wanted it to be funny, and I always say that, and it's funny.
Yeah. I think that the interaction between the boy and his father and the boy and his father's partner will play very well on screen. Some ways it may actually play better on screen even in the book, because some of it was very how can I say this? There were big chunks of the book where you could tell that the person who wrote the book had a lot of experience writing for the screen, because it's very visual that way. Now, I wanted to ask you, and I don't know – well, for, it's a two-part question, Richard.
Sure.
You may want to take notes. If first of all, the first part is this something you think you could have ever dreamed of writing when you were in high school or college, even when you did start writing more professionally? And then second, I don't know, and I don't care if you personally are straight or gay, but is that something people read this and they want to know? Do they want to talk to you about that at all? Or are they comfortable just talking about the book, or do they want to know something about you as well?
Well, I am gay, but I don't think of it as a gay book.
No, I don't either.
Thank you, because it's easy for it to get pigeonholed. And that's the thing that I've been fighting is to tell people this is not a gay book. This is a book that has some gay people in it. It is written by a gay man, but that doesn't make it a gay book. It's a book. Mm-hmm. And could I have written it when I was in high school? No way. You know, the book, I think that I waited as long as I did to write a book. You know, again, this is all that unconscious stuff, until I had enough of a vision of what life is to put down. And I could have, written a book 10 years ago, but I didn't. Mm-hmm. And it was when that vision of life, from what I had seen as a gay man who has lived largely in heterosexual circumstances, who has been in one way or another all the characters in this book, it was until I sort of got a bigger picture of what mattered for me in life that I was ready to write it. So I don't think any earlier point would have been right for this story. This is what I know so far. This story. I started working on another book that is totally different. But this is a summing up. And I learned a lot about writing books while I was writing it. I learned a lot about myself, you know, from doing it. And I learned I could write a book. I learned I could write a book that was this close to the bone for me and let people see it. I learned a lot during this. I'm very grateful to this book. And just, you know, one thing I want to add that about the father and, you know, in the adaptation, which I'm in the middle of doing, I had to leave a lot of the book behind in order to make it work. So, for example, the father has just left the mother in the TV show. So this is not a long-standing relationship that he has with his partner. He's very, very raw at this point in his life. And there's been this disruption that has been very recent. So that helped me. And the father is also not as cold. And also, for some reason, that wasn't important to me anymore. And also, the partner, whose name is George, is not as instantly warm. That takes some time. But I've been through three drafts until I arrived at that because I stayed very close to the book. But that seems to be where I am now. And one of the things that's been so helpful to me about this is this book has been like a mirror of where I am when I'm working on it in whatever form.
Are you trying to maintain the multiplicity of voices in the TV show, or are you just making it more traditional in that regard?
Well, you know, it's tradition. I can't maintain the multiplicity of voices. That's really a literary thing. Mainstream is a funny word in cable television. They've sort of invented their own mainstream. What they have done and what I have tried to do in writing this pilot is risk the characters being unlikable. That, to me, is still radical. And, you know, you look at every HBO show, you look at every Showtime show, they dare to have main characters who are not likable. And they have to become likable for another reason, in that you see yourself in them.
You know, Nurse Jackie or Hung, I'm just trying to...
Any of them.
Yeah, that's what they specialize in. A network show would have someone who is totally lovable and sympathetic, and the cable shows, whether it be an FX with It's Always Sunny or Archer or the paid cable like HBO or Showtime, these characters are not necessarily lovable or adorable or...
One of the things that's wonderful about the show Girls on HBO is that...
Please don't say the nudity.
No. But the nudity is part of it because she's showing a very imperfect body. And fortunately, she's also showing a very imperfect person. So the imperfect body is just an embodiment of the imperfect person. And each year, she has been less and less likable and more real. And that's, you know, that's true of her show, of Veep, you know, of True Detective, of Archer, as you say, every single one of them. It's now almost becoming a new template. But HBO urged me to make the characters not likable. And they said, make them real. Don't woo us. Don't charm us. Make them real. And that's incredible marching orders.
I was just thinking about another one. It only lasted a year, but Louis C.K.'s original series, Lucky Louie. Talk about unlikable.
Yeah. I mean, and his present show, which I just love. But that's the great fun of this. And, you know, the funny thing is I wrote this book to get out of television. That was one of the reasons. So I would not ever have to go do television again, which is just really, you know, a brutal existence. And like I said earlier, it's really for people who are willing to do the 18-hour day. But the funny thing is that it drew me back. It's like, you know, Al Pacino in Godfather 3. You know, it's just like, I'm back. Yeah.
So with the TV show, is it likely or not likely that there'd be a sequel or a prequel to the book? Or are you done with these characters in print?
I don't know. I have other characters who are waiting to, you know, who have their hands up waiting to be called on, you know, for other things. But for some reason, I never get tired of these characters. Mm. Never. I don't know why. I think it might be because they're all people who I wish I knew, even though I do know them. Mm-hmm. Even though a lot of them are me, even though some of them are my close or elements of close friends, but I want them with me all the time. They're my posse. Mm.
I can see
and that. I'd like to expand my posse, of course. But if this was my posse for my lifetime, I would still have this posse and I would feel perfectly fine about it.
Let's change gears a little bit.
We've
covered 30-something. We talked a little at the top about, and kidding mostly about Claire Danes and my so-called life. As you look back on that show, any regrets, anything, you know, you wish that you had done differently or anyone else had done differently that would have kept that show in production? Or was it just...
Well, you know, I wish I had done everything differently in my life. You know, I think that's... And certainly, you know, every writer, I mean, I'm sure you know this, feels that about everything that he's ever written. but there were things in that situation that were way beyond any of our control. And the key one was that she was so young. And she was carrying a show, and she simply it was too much to ask. So it would have been any kid who had not been doing it since they were 3 years old. Mm. And she was a normal girl from New York City with artsy parents and who had been very, you know, loved and protected.
Lena Dunham-like.
Exactly. Exactly. But Lena Dunham was in her mid-20s.
Right.
Big difference.
But artsy parents, New York City,
yes.
Very loved. Okay.
Very very protected, yeah. Very, very encouraged, you know, to be whoever she wanted to be. And she just, I don't want to say that she melted down because she didn't, but we felt terrible about putting this on her. And I remember during the first season of 30-something, those grown-ups were, it was killing them. And it's just... We couldn't do it to her anymore. Hmm. And she also just came to us and she said, I just don't think I can do it anymore. And none of us held it against her. We tried in the second half of the first season to make it more about the other kids and her parents. But she was the gold of that show. We're incredibly proud of, you know, how she's managed her life and her career since then. She's a really amazing person. She's a real artist, and she takes it very seriously. You know, she's doing great on Homeland, but she's also 32 years old. You know, it's a big difference. And so that's really what happened.
So answer the question. Is her character on Homeland, is it basically just that kid from that so-called my so-called life all grown up?
And I hope so. I hope not, because that would have mean she had a awful, you know, she would have become bipolar and, you know, obsessed with terrorists. And, you know, we think that what happened to Angela is that she became a photographer in New York, and that she lives in Soho, and she, you know, has two children and lives with a guy she's not married to, and is completely happy and complicated. Well, but she's not nuts.
Having seen that they managed to find a way to bring Veronica Mars back after all these years, is there any thought to coming back and revisiting Angela and that story, or is she...
Well, yeah, that's a funny idea. I mean, I think it would have to be generated by her, you know, and that's a very interesting idea, is what happened to Angela Chase.
Yeah.
You know, done as a movie or done as six episodes. You know, what happened to those kids? That's a very interesting idea. I mean, I should bring that up.
I'll take 10%. Just what I would do is not so much all the kids. I would just like to see – all right, and so I lied. I probably saw one episode of the show. I've probably seen one episode, maybe not in its entirety. But wouldn't it be interesting to see her as the parent of that 12 or 13, 14-year-old and how she's, you know, because they always say, you know, when you're a parent, it's karma. You get what you deserve as a parent based on the way you were as a teenager. So, you know, it'd be kind of interesting to see that. It'd be fascinating.
Yeah. You know, that was one of the great things that, you know, the show Secret Life of an American Teenager did with having Molly Ringwald as the mother, you know, who had been the emblem of teenage girlhood in the 80s. And that was so genius to see her, you know, suddenly matronly, you know, with a teenage, you know, kid of her own. Yeah. That's kind of a genius idea, is to see, you know, Angela with a teenager of her own.
Happy to help you out. Just let me know.
So bring that up.
All right. So the other show, of course, I have to ask about because I loved it, was Once and Again.
Yeah.
I just thought it was so much something we just had not seen. This, you know, people who were, you know, without their original spouses, never expecting to fall in love again, hence the title Once and Again, I think, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, bringing kids into the mix. And that first season of that show was just, it was gold. I just thought it was so perfect.
Oh, that's really nice to hear, because we don't hear that as much about that as about 30-something in my so-called life. I thought Once Again was beautiful, and it was a lot of fun to do.
It was just, I said it before, the chemistry was great. And then it was interesting because as the show went, I'm trying to remember, the show went into its third season?
It went all the way through 3 years.
3 years, okay. And by the third season, in some ways, I found that the kids had actually become more interesting than the parents, which was interesting because in the first season, I don't think I had any desire to see any more of those kids because they were, you know, they were dealing with all those issues of being pushed together. And but by the third season, the kids were actually getting to be kind of more interesting than the parents were in a certain way.
It had sort of grown into it. You know, we had this incredible girl, Evan Rachel Wood, who was, you know, 13 when we started. Mm-hmm. And she was just this, you know, nice girl, but she became more and more complex in life and on the show, so we could give her this stuff that was different than just, you know, teenage girl, you know, living with her, you know, her father and her new, you know, not even stepmother. They weren't even married.
Right.
And you know, Shane West, who played Eli, the son, was the same thing. They just became more and more interesting as people. In a way, it turned into my so-called life all over again. And you know, the adults, we sort of lost interest in them. We sort of ran out of stories to tell.
Right, right.
One of my favorite characters was Celia Ward's sister, Judy. She was a lot of fun to come up with stuff for. Usually the outlier is the one who is most interesting to write, the one who is least connected. And has more adventurous life experiences. Those are the ones that I like writing.
I think that actually happened on United States of Terror as well. I don't know if you ever saw that on Showtime, but
I did a couple times.
The girl who played Toni Collette was the star, right?
Yes.
Yeah. The woman who played her sister was actually bizarrely, compellingly interesting because of her tastes in men. Her bad boob job, you name it. I mean, it just seemed like you as interesting as Tara was with her multiple identities, her sister was pretty darn interesting too.
Yeah, yeah. That was a good show.
So what's the timeline? You said you've been through the pilot script three times. Where are you in terms of all that kind of happening down the line?
Well, literally, you know, today and tomorrow, I'm waiting to hear their reaction to the third draft of the pilot. And, you know, a lot will be determined from that. You know, I'll either get a phone call today or a phone call tomorrow, hear their thoughts, you know, positive or negative. So, you know, I'm a little bit on pins and needles.
Well, unfortunately, I know that they will not be trying to call through to you on Skype. So
we did fine.
Yeah, we just set this up. So I'm sure that this is not how they'd be trying to reach you. So
we did just fine.
Good luck with that. Yes, it did work out pretty well.
And I kept my gaze on that tiny green dot of light.
You've done a very fine job with that. Indeed.
Like in The Great Gatsby, remember the green light at the end of the dock that represented where Daisy was that he would look at?
Can I say that it's been so long since I read it that I don't remember? And well, I didn't watch the DiCaprio movie. I read it when I was probably about 13, and that's been a long time now.
That's the green light that represents hope. to F stars.
All right, I'll just play along with it. Sure. Okay. Well, listen, folks, this was fun. You can find Richard Kramer's first novel, These Things Happen, in great bookstores everywhere, in paperback now. Save a few bucks on that. Or you can order it right now at a great price at MrMedia.com. If you're watching us on the site, below the video somewhere, you'll see the cover of the book. You can click on it right this minute. You can download it, I'm sure, to your ebook reader immediately, or you can have it if you'd like to hold it in your hands while you're in the bathroom, whatever. You can push the button, and I'm sure they will use a drone and deliver it to you within a day.
Okay? God, yeah, just about.
And Richard, can people find you in social media? Your website?
Oh, absolutely. I have a website, which is richardkramer.com. I'm on Facebook at Richard L, which is my middle initial, _ Kramer. Okay. And I'm on Twitter, too, which is at Richard L _ Kramer.
Okay.
These underscores, I don't understand them. But I'm on every social media thing. I'm a monster on it.
All right. Just look for the guy who, you know, put all the words into those young teens' mouths. That doesn't sound right. Just look for Richard. Look for Richard L. Kramer. You'll find him. You'll find him. Richard, this was a lot of fun. Fascinating to get to talk to you.
I thank you so much, and thanks for getting us face to face.
Oh, my pleasure. My pleasure.
Okay.
And good luck. We'll look forward to hearing good things about the pilot. And
we'll talk soon.
All right. Thanks, Richard.
Okay. Bye bye.
Bye bye.
The preceding presentation was brought to you by The Realm Network.